This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 23rd of March, 2024.
And a very good morning to you. It's Emma Nelson here, broadcasting to you from Midori House in London. Coming up on Monocle on Saturday, well, I'm joined by Simon Brooke to go through the papers. Good morning, Simon.
Good
what
morning.
Have you spotted?
Well, obviously, a lot of coverage of the attacks in Moscow and speculation about who could be behind it and what is the motivation for it. Also, coverage here in the UK and actually, I noticed in the US and across Europe of the announcement by the Princess of Wales here that she is being treated for cancer, plus also reaction to the UN Security Council vote yesterday on Gaza and the Middle East.
Thank you very much indeed. We'll also be hearing from our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, as he gears up for the Hanami market in Dufourstrasse 90 in Zurich. That's all coming up on Monocle on Saturday with me, Emma Nelson. And a very good morning to you from a bright and breezy London. We will be crossing to Switzerland in a little while, where they're gearing up for the Hanami market in Dufourstrasse 90. By all accounts, London has the sunshine today. What we also have is Simon Brooke. Well, not what, who we also have. How are you, Simon?
I'm very well, thank you, Emma. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
Sort of quite astonished by the fact that we no longer operate in full darkness. A friend of mine once told me that in London, between about September and the end of March, the United Kingdom is placed in the equivalent of a Tupperware box, that a grey lid is clamped firmly over the country. And then only in the beginnings of March and April do people sort of gently prise open the lid to see what is inside and hope that it is still fresh. And one very much gets the impression that London's coming back to life this weekend.
It is spring. There are tulips, there are daffodils, there are crocuses. As you say, it's light when you get up in the morning, especially if you're doing an early morning radio show. And that does make a huge difference, doesn't it? And I think there's something quite almost animal, isn't there, about, well, there is, about the fact that getting up in the dark it goes against nature, doesn't it? You should still be asleep. So I think it does make a huge difference. And I think it's interesting now that people are exploring this idea of seasonal affectiveness disorder, and you can actually buy a lamp, can't you, to give you that light you need. But there is something about British grey weather. I remember having this conversation with a colleague from New York who's complaining about British weather, and I said, oh, come on, I've been to New York when it's been so cold I thought I was going to die, freeze to death. I've been to New York when I thought I was going to faint with heat. And he said, yeah, you get that extreme, but he said, but there's nothing like the British grey, deep grey sky. And I thought, yeah, there is something about that greyness which is soul destroying.
And it absolutely lacks the romance of Parisian grey. And I've never quite managed to work out why. I wonder whether it is the greyness of the buildings in Paris which create a rather sombre beauty. I mean, when you talk about the idea of melancholy being a rather wonderful thing that everybody experiences, the joy of melancholy can be really experienced in Paris, whereas in London we're just cross and miserable.
Yeah, it's just miserable, isn't it? Yeah.
Much more prosaic. How's the week for Simon Brooke been?
Yes, good. Busy, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I have been talking to a lot of companies about the way that they're trying to get business going together. And I know we're going to be looking at Japan shortly, aren't we? And so talking to companies about exporting and trying to overcome the obstacles that Brexit, geopolitical uncertainty and other things have put in their way. But it feels like there's quite a bit of optimism out there.
Indeed, the weather's dreadful, but I've always been told never to talk about the weather on the radio, but frankly, it's all we can think about in London.
Everyone, yeah, especially
I'm sorry
the British.
About that. But the idea that actually there is a real sense of life and spirit in London, that so many other nations at the moment and countries where you go to are thinking, oh, we're going into a decline, going into a decline. Whereas in actual fact, for the last couple of months, I think we've been talking about the decline in the UK. London has just thought, forget that, brushed it off its shoulders and is powering ahead. Do you feel that as well?
I think certainly, as I say, talking to companies across the spectrum when I'm looking for stories and stuff, there does seem to be a feeling that, I mean, and obviously, if you look at the statistics as well, or the official figures with interest rates probably coming down with some sort of growth appearing, that there does seem to be a feeling almost determination that despite all the challenges we face, companies will, businesses will want to try and survive. And actually some people quite enjoy the challenge, really, you know, that if there is a difficult economic situation, they quite like the idea of that challenge, as I say, and be able to bounce back and overcome those obstacles.
Always up for a little bit of a fight. Not an enormous one, but just enough. Right. Huge stories that I think in the last 24 hours, anybody who is on a forward planning desk on a newspaper, you can make a noise with newspapers.
Sorry, I've never got the papers. Let's ruffle
those hard copies around. Indeed, if only you could see how gingerly Simon was trying to move a copy of the FD.
Let's rustle. We've got the papers with us.
Satisfying.
We love it. Saturday morning, why not?
So if you were on the planning desk of a major newspaper or a major newsroom yesterday, you would have kind of got your ducks in a row for the week for next week. You would have sort of thought, OK, we've got Gaza and the continued efforts to bring about some sort of ceasefire. You would think we've got Ukraine and you would think we've got Europe. But in actual fact, everything turned on a pin within about 2 hours yesterday, didn't it? Two enormous stories break. Firstly, we have this attack on a theatre in Moscow. And secondly, we have the announcement that the Princess of Wales has cancer. Two stories which would really, really vie for the front pages of any newspaper on earth, actually. Both incredibly unusual, both very, you know, and deeply sad. Let's deal with the Russia story first, because this is one of those things that it unfolds. And suddenly you think, as Le Figaro has said today, this is Moscow's Bataclan.
Mm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, as you say, yes, if you're any kind of journalist at the moment, especially anybody looking at the global picture, you would be thinking Russia is all about Putin and the next move that he might take, further repression at home, possible new adventures, planning aggression abroad. You'd think that was the story with regard to Russia. But now, as you say, absolutely. So we know now, and this has been leading almost all the papers that I've looked at around the world this morning, 62 people killed in this concert hall near Moscow. Four masked men armed with automatic weapons were responsible. And yes, as you say, this is Russia's worst terrorist attack in about 20 years. The Crocus City Hall near Moscow, a fire then broke out after the event, and it's thought that about 6,000 people were actually at the venue. I think one of the interesting things, just looking at the media coverage of this, is in this really fragmented world, this is probably one of the very few incidents that really has united world leaders, with governments in China, India, alongside the US, the EU and the UN, of course, and the Kremlin itself, all condemning this action. It looks like it's a branch of Islamic State, which this particular branch is called ISIS-K, according to security sources. And this is the Islamic State's Afghan branch. ISIS-K, the K there stands for the Islamic State Khorasan, and Khorasan is a sort of historic name for a region that included parts of Iran, Turkmenistan and Afghanistan. And this, the ISIS-K emerged in eastern Afghanistan in about 2014, and it does have a history of attacks inside and outside the country. And it sees Russia as being complicit in activities that oppress Muslims, hence this attack.
The New York Times has done a big feature on ISIS-K. It says Islamic State has been trying to increase its external attacks, according to US counterterrorism officials. There's this one extraordinary moment, isn't there, that the United States has been using its intelligence to monitor what Russia has been doing, A, in the run-up to its invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, but also since then. Intelligence coming from Washington has been second to none. And yet also we have the United States intelligence working to support and protect Russia, because it has been saying that for, 2 years, says the United States, according to the New York Times, ISIS-K has been fixated on Russia, frequently criticising Putin in its propaganda. And you just get this thought that actually that you sort of surpass alliances and you sort of cast aside the fact that they may be your enemy. If there is a public risk from a terrorist group, you know, they have been telling Moscow for a long time that this was a problem.
It is interesting, isn't it? When you think of the tone of the conversation over certainly the last 2 years since the invasion of Ukraine, and even before that, the tone of the conversation between Washington and the Kremlin has been very aggressive. And as you say, this is an element of my enemy's enemy is my friend sort of thing. You know, this as you say, does move beyond the Ukraine situation. I think what's also interesting as well is why did this happen? Did the Kremlin take its eye off the ball because it's so fixated with crushing opposition to Putin internally and looking at the situation in Ukraine? So that's one question, obviously, people might be asking. The other question is, where does this leave Vladimir Putin? Does it make him look weaker or stronger? You could say makes him look weaker because, as I say, he wasn't aware that this was going to happen, or if there were reports, he didn't act on them. So that could be difficult. If he says he's the strong man, yes, you have to give up individual freedoms. There can be no opposition, but don't worry, I'll look after you, which is in some ways a sort of classic populist view, if you like. But this is the strong man. On the other hand, you could also say that it leaves him weaker. If this thing has happened, does he look like he isn't that strong man? I suppose one thing he will try and do now, if I was advising him, would be to play this into the paranoia narrative, this idea that Russia is under attack from around the world, and therefore we need to be in a constant state of readiness, and this is why we are militarizing society and the economy.
Let's move on to another story. The diagnosis of Princess Catherine, the Princess of Wales. She went on television last night, well, pre-recorded film on it was recorded in Windsor, I think, on Wednesday, which was played out at the top of the BBC 6 o'clock news, where she revealed that she had cancer. Now, obviously, this is a dreadful personal, you know, catastrophe for the family, because if you think about Prince William, he's got both his father and his wife now suffering from cancer. But let's look at it from the point of view of the way that this has been covered. For starters, I think that obviously the way that the King's cancer was publicised and the narrative that was pushed out, it came as a major, major shock for all the news outlets that were told that, I think they were given, I know that one major news outlet was given about 25 minutes to get its act together to actually put things out. And there had been, you know, there was one of those things that there was a real need of communication between the palace and the big major news outlets, and not least to find an appropriate photograph to broadcast, to choose the appropriate words and this, that and the other. The reaction to Catherine's cancer, it was a very strange thing watching the 6 o'clock news again, because they used the same format, and one thought, we've been here before. It was a very unusual thing to watch.
It was. I have to say, I mean, I think what's the difference here is obviously the as you say, the media context, both conventional media and social media, particularly social media. The Guardian, for instance, has a piece just looking at the crazy conspiracy theories that were circulating on social media. Questions that she had a body double, that she was in a coma, that she was recovering from plastic surgery, or that she was in fact dead, according to the Guardian, which has looked at these conspiracy theories. And so I think it's interesting that unlike the announcement of the King's cancer, in this case, there was very much a feeling that the palace had to now say this to combat these crazy theories, not just in social media, but also the constant discussion in the media. And I think what's interesting is obviously talking to friends who work for, should we say, more tabloid titles, they're saying they're very sensitive now about sort of intrusions into people's personal lives. So the way the media has been covering this story is to cover the media coverage of it, if that makes sense.
It does. And it always goes back to the main question that you have to ask, which is, how much do you say as a spokesperson? Not necessarily, you know, because the media creates, it is an insatiable animal. And the fact that no information was coming out from Kensington Palace was possibly, well, I think you and I would both agree, because we've talked about this several times. If you don't say something, it doesn't mean that we're not going to talk about it. And then you get those so-called experts on panels, and that creates a real problem, because a spokesperson can on Kensington Palace loses control of the story. There's a much better sense that now that Catherine had spoken by herself in an incredibly warm, straightforward and genuine way, that everyone will now go away. And it's a great lesson in communications.
It is, absolutely. Yeah, we always say that you know, nature abhors a vacuum. If you don't say anything, then something else will come up. I think what's particularly unusual about this situation, and the palace has made this very clear, was that the Catherine and William were trying to find a way of telling their young children. And I think there's a sort of, I mean, it's interesting just to look at the coverage. I mean, I always find if you look at the comments, it gives you a good insight into what people might be thinking. And there is a very fierce reply in the Times by one reader just saying, OK, social media, now how do you feel? And I notice that's the top comment, and it's got, I don't know, 300, 400 likes, including from me, I have to say.
Yeah, take control of the narrative and people will just calm down.
Yeah.
Right, the time here in London is 9:15 a.m. You're listening to Monocle on Saturday with me, Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio is Simon Brooke. Joining me on the telephone is our editorial director, Tyler Brûlé. Good morning to you, Tyler. How are you?
Good morning, Emma. I'll tell you, the winds have not calmed down here, though. On the topic of making things a bit more tranquil, it is absolutely blustery here in Zurich this morning. And it's one of those moments where you think, you know, weather services, be they British, French, Swiss, are they just running all on algorithms? And is anybody actually, after the rain and wind and various radars that you think that these organizations have, because there was no weather warning. Now the streets are just sort of filled with leaves and, sakura petals and everything else.
Oh, goodness me. It's one of those things that I actually thought, have you just thought about looking out of the window, Met Office, and telling us what's going on?
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's like, you know, you don't have to go and do a weather warning 24 hours in advance. Actually, 30 minutes warning would be good for us to adjust the lanterns, because as I said, referencing sakura, it is our sakura market in Zurich, which got underway about, 15, 20 minutes ago, kicked off at 10 o'clock here in Zurich this morning. I do see a little bit of blue. In fact, I see a lot of blue to the west of the city. So hopefully this fine weather is arriving from France, but the winds need to die down before our lanterns sort of, you know, blow all the way over to Austria.
At least you'll all be covered in petals, which will obviously be incredibly pretty, but terrible to clear up
indeed
afterwards. Tell us a little bit more about the market. This is the second time you've done it, isn't it?
It is the, it could actually be the third installment, or at least it's maybe the second one under this current brand. And of course, you know, this is the time of the year in the Northern Hemisphere where we see the cherry blossoms coming out. Monocle's always had a very strong connection to Japan. And so this is a new adventure. Emma, you'll be familiar. We have this lovely ramp that goes down to the garage in our modernist building in Zurich. That is all now sort of, you have these sort of steps that go down with various stall holders doing, you know, fantastic buns and yakitori and various Japanese pastries. And then we've brought in, you know, all of the most interesting Japanese-based brands here in Zurich. So Kazu Hugler, who's graced the pages of Confect in the early days, does, you almost say it's almost a couture business, but there's also a ready-to-wear component where she's deconstructing kimono and using kimono fabric and just doing the most amazing blouses and robes and smoking jackets. I think just kind of probably up Emma Nelson Street, I would say. And then we've also had our colleague Tomo come over from Tokyo, from our Tokyo operation, and he has just brought like a great, you know, sampling of just what is interesting in the world of Japanese popular culture at the moment. So everything from maybe the face wipes you might want to the current mangas that are interesting to read to, of course, a great selection of Japanese magazines as well.
And I wonder what it must be like that when you organise an event like this, that all the considerable Japanese population of Zurich suddenly find themselves almost physically drawn to do Vorstrasse 90.
Exactly. We have, of course, some subscribers, and of course, yeah, other members of the Japanese community who are very much, I would say, part of our orbit. But then, as you said, then there's, of course, a broader community in the banking, tech, and pharma sector here as well, who, of course, you know, hear about this, you know, on the grapevine somehow, and they make their way. And it's always great sort of seeing the newcomers, you know, who might live on the other side of the lake or who are a little bit further away. They might come from Basel or somewhere. And then they're just delighted because, you know, I think what we try to do as well is present a more modern face of Japan as well. And also introducing people, a lot of people don't realize how many Japanese bakers and suppliers there are in and around the city as well. Just for our own baked good needs, we have three different Japanese suppliers just for our own cafe in Zurich.
Now, that doesn't surprise me that there is a fundamental baked good need that needs to be addressed by Monocle.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, one of the I don't know, it's the best croissant or the best chocolate croissant in Switzerland, which, of course, you know, that's pretty high stakes if you can say it's the best. And there is a baker named Sari Wada-san, and he has obviously a wonderful bakery, but also he supplies to many other outlets as well. And, you know, he's always in sellout mode. And of course, yes, you can get his croissants at our cafe as well.
Queues around the corner, I can imagine. So this is what, this weekend you are doing this, but then you hop on a plane off to Hong Kong.
Yes, well, actually to Tokyo. This is interesting, and it maybe goes back to the Sakura story as well. You would think out of Zurich that I would have been able to get a plane to Tokyo tonight. Absolutely not. Are absolutely rammed. I tried to book a ticket 2 weeks ago, and there were no tickets available. So off I go on the TGV to Paris this afternoon, and then jump on an Air France flight to Tokyo tomorrow. There for a couple of days, Emma, and then land in Hong Kong on Wednesday, and that's going to be the reception that evening and the lead into our Chiefs conference, third edition of our Chiefs, first one was the Emirates, Dallas last year. And now we find ourselves in Hong Kong later this week. And this is really the first, if you hear the wind picking up here in the background, this is the first edition of scale of any of our conference franchises that we've done in Asia.
So tell us a little bit about how the focus is going to work this year in Hong Kong, because a lot of the world and a lot of the world's newspapers are looking at Hong Kong with quite a sceptical eye. What is it that the Chiefs Conference is going to be able to do to try and address that and actually take a bit of a deep dive into where Hong Kong sits at the moment?
So the focus of the Chiefs, it's a leadership conference. So rather than having large panels, it tends to be one-on-ones. We might have maybe, you know, one editor talking to two others or three others on stage. Big focus on retail, also just, you know, and then again in the spirit of leadership, talking to entrepreneurs who have launched new businesses and how is it to navigate your business, not just, you know, in Hong Kong but in the wider region. I think the other thing that we wanted to do as well, I think both from a Hong Kong perspective, is also bring in a bit more of Asia as well. So a great lineup of speakers, also coming from Japan, also coming from Thailand, also coming from Indonesia, and of course having that conversation. I think that, you know, one of the interesting things that we've noticed is, yeah, of course, we had our James Chambers and our Naomi Shu Elegant. They've been based in Hong Kong. They're now based in both Singapore and Bangkok reporting for us. Of course, coming back into Hong Kong and reporting from there as well, we I would say, pulled them out, or we gave them the opportunity after the pandemic to decide where they want to go and to do their job. But it's been interesting. I think sort of, you know, watching the mechanics of them doing journalism as well. And of course, you know, they come back and they report out of Hong Kong with pretty much no problem. Now, of course, it depends on what you are reporting on as well. Of course, you know, we've not been shy in reporting on the security issue certainly the security bill that passed there as well. But I think there is a little bit of a conversation. There's all eyes on Hong Kong. But you have to remember as well, it's not easy reporting sometimes out of Thailand if you want to say various things about the king, likely you'll find yourself, you know, behind bars, or certainly maybe barred from Thailand. You know, likewise, you know, it's not such an easy situation in Singapore either. So, we want to use the measure of maybe, you know, what it's like doing the job as a journalist in Europe, or certainly in other countries. It's a different yardstick in many parts, of course, that region.
And then, of course, if you are starting up a business, or if you're the CEO of a business in that region and eyeing Hong Kong, one wonders where the opportunities are now and how you actually, you seize upon the fact that Hong Kong is still incredibly dynamic, geographically incredibly relevant, and, you know, it still has a very strong beating heart.
And that's part of why the reason we chose Hong Kong for the conference. And I could say that, you know, in the case of Dallas last year, Dallas chose us. Dallas was actively wooing us and wanted us to come and do the conference. We looked across Asia and decided where would we do it. And I think it was probably after the second or third trip last year, back in just when Hong Kong was getting back in its groove, Emma, that you really felt just that this is still probably the most efficient city of scale for doing business. It's not in Asia, the world, that they're very good at getting you, on and off the aircraft, you know, whisking you into town. And then there's just this, there's the scale of the place, the way, you know, the interaction between Hong Kong Island, you know, and Kowloon, making that journey, into central, being able to, of course, cover an extraordinary amount of ground. And I said, that's the one amazing thing about the place, that you can efficiently do, you know, 8 or 9 meetings a day, and also, you know, fit in a fantastic breakfast and a great lunch with clients and a wonderful dinner and go to a bar afterwards. You know, these components are all very much part of Hong Kong. And, of course, we've been doing check-ins from there, just you and me, over the last year. And that's one of the remarkable things. And we want to remind people that this is one of probably the best places to do business. And listen, it's a stated fact. This, you know, this is going to be China's. This is China's springboard, red carpet into China. That is, in many ways as well, if I think what Beijing was saying, well, it was going to be Shanghai's role, I think there's this acceptance now, especially if you're a Western business as well, the softer landing is going to be in Hong Kong.
Tyler, I have a mental image of you tilted at 45 degrees, collar up into the wind. How correct is that?
Not quite. No collar, unfortunately. Just a round neck jumper. But it has actually started to calm down a little bit. I'm going to make my way down the lake, I think, where the storm is still raging. Because the other thing we've got coming up, Emma, is we're launching. We talked about the Oxen, which is our new little side spin-off, our little small hotel venture that is being done by another part of our business. But it's going to feature a Monocle suite. It's going to be the first Monocle suite anywhere in the world. And it's a two-bedroom apartment in a wonderful old Gasthof just down the lake in Zurich. That's going to open for business on October the 5th. It's missing some bedside tables. It's missing a sideboard. and it's missing some essential lighting. So I'm going to be, I'm heading to one of my favorite vintage stores right now to see that in these intervening days while I'm in Asia, that they can rustle up some good Swiss modernist bedside tables and maybe a few other knickknacks as well.
Sounds like amazing good fun. Thank you so much, Tyler Brulé in Zurich. Simon Brook, just listening to that real passion and interest for Hong Kong. And also, let's talk a little bit earlier about, as what Tyler was mentioning about this market in Dufourstrasse 90, the level of quality and the Switzerland's best croissant, the most beautiful kimono robes deconstructed. That's attention to detail, passion, love and craftsmanship that actually we sort of slightly crave nowadays, don't we?
I think we do. And I think actually it's interesting, as you connect those two countries and cultures, Switzerland and Japan, two countries, two cultures where being the absolute best is just kind of part of the DNA, really, isn't it? And I was talking earlier this week, I had a visit to Ettinger, which is a British brand of leather goods, which you probably know. They make wallets and other leather accessories and stuff. And they were, Robert Ettinger, who's the boss there at the moment, was telling me amazing stories about the Japanese buyers from the big department stores coming in to look at his goods. And he says, obviously, they get buyers from around the world. But he said the Japanese are the ones where they literally come with a magnifying glass to look at every stitch and work out how many stitches per centimetre. And he said, actually, we'll just leave them in the showroom. They'll be there for hours looking at every piece in absolute amazing detail just to check that. And somebody else who works quite a lot in Japan was telling me this, you probably heard it, that in the big department stores, they will change the music if it starts raining outside so that the shop staff know to give you a plastic bag rather than a paper bag, i.e. one that's not going to melt in the rain. But it's that level of detail, which I just find absolutely fascinating.
Simon Brooke, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. That's all the time we have for today's programme for Monocle on Saturday. The warmest of thanks to my guests, Simon Brooke and Tyler Brulé. Thanks also to the producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. And thanks to you for listening. Monocle on Saturday returns next weekend. I'm Emma Nelson. I'll be around for Monocle on Sunday tomorrow if you can join me for that. Look forward to speaking to you then. But until tomorrow, goodbye. Thanks for listening.